Yebisinga bosa na mboka wana isebe bana yango Fanana yo na mputu salama kamumayo Ngana zomiseli bango kongo kino liwa Na kokunde la bose mboko na bandeko banga Makila mazali kotanga mokili ebo ikomona Iwa ya moto moindu wa ezali eloko
Well, greetings, and welcome to Caribbean Forum here on this 316th day of the year 2011. You're tuned into the Uhuru Radio Network, where we expand our ability to communicate and unite the struggles of African people towards victory and independence in our lifetime. I'm Ron Bob Semple, and here on the Forum, we examine issues that affect Caribbean and Caribbean American nationals, both at home and across the diaspora. We'll bring you news, views, interviews, thought-provoking discussions, Caribbean theater of the mind, and of course, musical interludes. Now, this week's broadcast will focus on the upcoming presidential general elections in the South American nation of Guyana, which is scheduled for Monday, November 28th. Earlier this week, the Faculty of Social Sciences at the University of Guyana presented four of the major candidates during a forum at the George Walcott Lecture Theater on the Turkine campus. They were Alfred Granger, and he's the representative of the opposition coalition, A Partnership for National Unity. And also joining him was Peter Prasad of the United Force, Kemraj Ramjetan of the Alliance for Change, the AFC, and Donald Ramatar, representing the ruling party, the People's Progressive Party, Civic. We'll bring you that forum in its entirety as the candidates made an effort to sway the minds of the students of the university. The People's Progressive Party has been in office for the past 19 years, and many Guyanese feel that it's time for a change. And also, we'll share with you an interview I had with music icon Byron Lee just 5 months before he succumbed to cancer on November 5th in the year 2008. So tell someone that Caribbean Forum is on the air for the next 2 hours here on the Uhuru Radio Network. We're here every Saturday from 9 until 11 Eastern Standard Time and return on Sunday evenings from 7 until 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time for Golden Sunday Sounds, where we relive those romantic and love songs of yesteryear. Well, here is the 2011 Guyana General Elections Presidential Forum, which was held at the University of Guyana on November 10th.
Brigadier retired David Granger is a former commander of the Guyana Defense Force and national security advisor to the president. He is a graduate of the University of Guyana, where he received his bachelor and master's degree. The University of the West Indies, where he received the postgraduate diploma in international relations. And the University of Maryland, where he was a Hubert Humphrey Fellow. He also attended the Urban Policy Development Workshop at the University of California, Los Angeles, the Defense Planning and Resource Management Course at the National Defense University, Washington, D.C., and the Counterterrorism Educators Workshop at the Joint Special Operations University, Florida, USA. Brigadier Granger received his military training at the Mons Officer Cadet School and the School of Infantry in the United Kingdom, the Jungle Warfare Instruction Center in Brazil. He is a member of several defense and security agencies, holding the chairmanship of Central Intelligence Committee, co-chairmanship of the Border and National Security Committee, and membership of the Ghana Defense Board, National Drug Law Enforcement Committee, and the Discipline Service. Brigadier Granger has written extensively on national defense and public security issues. Brigadier Granger is married to Sandra Nay Chanasu, and he is the father of two daughters. Brigadier Granger.
Thank you, Madam Chairperson. Members of the Diplomatic Corps, members of staff, students, fellow candidates, I'd like to congratulate the University of Ghana for launching this initiative, and I'd like to express my gratitude for giving us this opportunity to speak to you. And of course, it's good to be back at the George Walter Lecture Theatre. Diana's future is right here today in the George Walker Lecture Theatre. You are the future. You are the future of Ghana. It cannot be otherwise. And the gateway to all future, to this country's future, is education. H.G. Wells said several decades ago that human history has become more and more a race between education and catastrophe. Yes, catastrophe triumphs where education fails. Catastrophe triumphs where ignorance prevails. Education is the backbone, the bedrock of national development. And the University of Ghana and the Sir Porter College of Education are the bedrock on which the education system in Ghana is founded. Education is the mother of economic growth. Education is the mother of employment. Education is the mother of empowerment. But what is the situation in Ghana today? For over 19 years, the People's Progressive Party Civic has damaged the education system, the very foundation. It normally continues to damage the system even today. It feels that nothing must prevent its total domination of society, even at the cost of your education. The People's Progressive Party Civic has endangered your future. The education system after 19 years is in a mess. After 19 years, 600 children are dropping out of school every month. After 19 years, 12,000 students writing the National Grade 6 examination this year failed in all four subjects. After 19 years, 70% of the students writing the Caribbean Secondary Education Certificate fail in English and mathematics. After 19 years, after 19 years, 60% of Guyanese children in grades 2 to 4 could not recognize a single word after 19 years. These are children who were born under the People's Progressive Party Civic Administration. After 19 years, 40% of our nursery, primary, and secondary school teachers are unqualified and untrained. After 19 years, 4 out of 5 graduates in Guyana migrate. Shall we give the PPP another 19 years? No way. No way. What do you get in return? You get the Gopal Doctrine. And you should pay attention to Gopal, because he's the permanent secretary in the office of the president, a very powerful man. This is the Gopal Doctrine. The government was always dissatisfied with the manner in which the University of Ghana was administered. And to date, some of that dissatisfaction still exists. Now we come to the good part. The problems of the University of Ghana are immense and have always been complicated by the academics. That is what he says. He's blaming the academics, who more often than not see things differently as against those who formulate policies. The government has done nothing for 19 years, poor academics. They filled the board with 10 members of the Central Executive Committee and 10 of the stalwarts, and yet they blame the academics for the situation that the university is in. That's the Gopal doctrine for you. A partnership for national unity is a grouping of 10 political organizations for the first time in the history of this country. 10 parties have come together to move the PPP out of office. The partnership is committed, above all, to providing a good life for you, you who must inherit the future. In particular, our emphasis will be on education. And I want to speak to you most of all about education, because that is the partnership's greatest concern. We want to make Guyana an education nation again. We will guarantee your future, while the PPP has been blind to the squalor that surrounds our campuses. They've been deaf to your cries. The solution, and I address this comment to the government, the solution is not to try to control every single council and commission in the country. The solution is to ensure that the university gets what it needs. And a partnership for national unity will give the University of Ghana what it needs to give you a quality education. We're not going to fight you down for funds. How can you run a university like this on $1 billion? You need $4 billion, and we'll give you that money. You'll get a quality education. The solution is not to dominate the council of the university. The solution is to provide adequate funding for the university, to support our teachers and lecturers who are the lifeblood of the education system. And we, in a partnership, have promised that teachers and lecturers will be the best paid public servants in Guyana. We are going to give teachers and lecturers higher salaries, longer tenure, and we promise you, eat by lips, one laptop per lecturer. OLPL. But what concerns you most? You are concerned about your fees. The best way to repay student loans is by giving you and guaranteeing jobs when you leave the University of Ghana. Once you leave here, a partnership for national unity will give you a job. We are going to, no more bus conducting, no more working in restaurants. You will get a job fitting your qualifications. Throughout our education system, we go into schools, there are no laboratories, there are no libraries. Look at what you have here. We are going to give you international class laboratories, because we intend to train scientists, engineers, technologists, and mathematicians. STEM, scientists, technicians, engineers, and mathematicians. Remember that. That's the STEM. We will improve your physical infrastructure here. We don't want chancellors like Bertie Ramsrand complaining that when he's on campus here, lecturers are running up asking him for furniture for his classrooms. By the way, you also got the stables over there? We can move the stables. Stables are for horses. Stables not for humans. Tables of humans. those theaters were temporary 25 years ago. I promise elsewhere, and I promise again, not only the campus, but the whole of Georgetown will be an internet hotspot. Wherever you go in Georgetown. We intend to reverse the trend of migration of students. People will want to come back because the pay is so good, because the conditions are so good. That is how it used to be, and that is the future. That is how it will be in the future. Our promise to you, a Partnership for National Unity promises you, that we will not hold back your development because of an impaired education system. What we have in Ghana now is academic apartheid. The large portion of the population is being held back in illiteracy by the small elite advances. We want to give everybody a break to move this country forward. The People's Progressive Party has betrayed you by robbing you of your future. You asked for education and they gave you the President's Youth Choice Initiative. You asked for employment and they gave you the President's Youth Award, Republic of Guyana. A Partnership for National Unity will unleash your innovation, will unleash your investigative capabilities, will unleash your interests. We will allow you to use your energy and your passion to propel this country forward and at the same time to make yourself and your family rich. This is a competitive millennium and we will raise Turkine to the level of Mona and St. Augustine. Our plan is to give you better education so you have a better university. From a better university, you'll have better employment. And from better employment and better education, you'll have a better Ghana. This is my promise to you today, University of Ghana students. May God bless you. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Alan Bomar Jones, and you're listening to Caribbean Forum with Ron Bob Simple.
Our next speaker is Mr. Peter Passard, presidential candidate for the United Force. Mr. Passard is a prominent member of civil society, a community activist and a strong advocate for the rights and interests of the indigenous people of Guyana. He is a staunch member of the Roman Catholic community and owes a debt of gratitude to the Catholic nuns, priests, and village sisters, including his grandmother, for their strong Catholic teachings which guide him in his daily endeavors. A son of Amerindian origin, he was born on June 26, 1961. His primary education was obtained at Santa Cruz and Santa Rosa Roman Catholic Primary Schools in the Moruga sub-region of the Borima Waini area in Region 1. He then attended the Muslim Educational Trust College, where he obtained his secondary education. His academic development was curtailed by the prevailing financial circumstances after the death of his grandmother, which forced Peter Passard into a world of work at a tender age so that he could contribute to the upkeep of his mother and young sister. Mr. Passard joined the United Force in 1985, a year when he campaigned throughout the length and breadth of Guyana. Peter has held the position as General Secretary of the party, a position to which he was re-elected in 1995. On March 2, 1993, his concern for his fellow Amerindians inspired him to form the Amerindian Action Movement of Guyana to protect and defend the rights of the indigenous communities and peoples. Peter is also the representative of that party on the Multi-Stakeholder Steering Committee. His valuable work as a leader in civil society and a community activist has gained him the respect of other civil society leaders and the nation as a whole. He was nominated as a member of the Women and Gender Equality Commission a position he holds with much respect. And he was elected to serve on the Ethnic Relations Commission by the Women and Gender Equality Commission and its representatives. I now bring you the presidential candidate for the senior.
Thank you, Madam Chairperson. First of all, let me say that I am very much happy to be here. Let me also greet members of the head table, fellow presidential candidates, members of the diplomatic community, staff members of the University of Vienna, students all. As I said before, I am pleased to be associated with this event and more so honored to be invited by the Department of Government and International Affairs of the University of Vienna. I understand that this is a presidential debate. We want to hear from us. I heard Mr. Granger, fellow presidential candidate, and I want to say now, what role did Mr. Granger play in advancing the cause for Guyana, for Guyana's development? Mr. Granger was a high-ranking army official in the Guyana Defense Force when ballot boxes were seized under the administration of the People's National Congress so that final elections could have massively rigged in this country. And what happened during those years, we had three rise to our porridge. Many of you might not know, I passed through that. Let me say now, before I delve into my presentation, that we in this country have to be civilized. We have to understand the issue in a civilized manner. And I want to say that the other opposition parties are totally unqualified to lead this country. I want you all to know that the United States economic policy is the free enterprise capitalist system that will place each and every one of you in the sun. Brothers and sisters, the United States political party was founded in the year 1960 by a Portuguese businessman whose name was Peter Stanislaus de Garre, who gloriously said in the introduction of the United States first agenda, highways to happiness. And I quote, "Let us lift our eyes to the high places. May we each, in our own way, be grateful to a divine being, to a divine power." The United States political party firmly believes in the supremacy of God and its guidance as we continually focus on our party's mission, which is a commitment to the building of a united, strong, and great Guyana by the application of democratic principles, rule of law, a rewarding labor force, and a socially just market economy driven by people's enterprise capitalist system. With full respect for our environment. In this connection, brothers and sisters, students of the University of Guyana, the United Force is fully committed itself to be an ideal government and is fully committed for the construction of an ideal state. While our manifesto all of Jungle for Action will be launched in a few days, I still will reveal to you our plan. First of all, our party's manifesto will be launched in a few days' time, where you will have the opportunity to peruse it. And as you are aware, the United First Party is a veteran in the application of one democracy as well as its economic policy of the free enterprise capitalist system. We've all been hearing about the taxation system. We've all been hearing about VAT. We've all been hearing about the PAY system and other taxes. But my friends, students, I want to say that maybe some of you are students of economics or maybe in social sciences. You would be appealing to the other opposition parties what they will do in terms of eliminating certain taxes, such as VAT. They will reduce PAYE and other taxes. The question is, if you reduce these taxes, we have to. Let me tell you, we all have brains so that we can all think. If we eliminate or reduce these taxes, we need to know where are we going to get the money from to expand the social sectors of this economy, such as health, education, rural development, and other issues, the University of Guyana. Mr. Green is talking about the advancement of the University of Guyana, but yet he cannot tell you where the money is going to come from. We need to be fair to you to tell you where are we going to get the money from to expand our social services. How can we transform this University of Guyana? The United Force will review the tax system against the performance of our economy, its economic performance, its financial strength, so we can be justified if we can raise the income tax threshold to $75,000 a month. We need to examine these things. We just can't come here to give one talk. We need to be responsible political parties. We need to tell you the truth. Because if we say that we are going to increase the income tax threshold or reduce the income tax threshold, we need to ask ourselves, where will the other monies come from to develop the other social sectors? Simple economics. But I must say that what happened on the AFC, because the need for votes can tell you anything, just to get your votes. The United First Political Party is not like that. We tell you the truth. And this is where we stand. Thank you very much.
You're listening to Caribbean Forum with Ron Bobsample here on the Uhuru Radio Network.
We now move on to the third presentation, and this will be from Mr. Kemraj Ramjetan, presidential candidate from the Alliance for Change. And remember, I remind you again, please allow the presenter to give an uninterrupted presentation. I'll now share with you some bio information about Mr. Kemraj Ramjetan. He was born on October 12, 1960, at number 48 Village, Quarantine, Burbank. He is an eminent attorney of law, a fearless and objective politician, and a volunteer youth organizer. his profession as an attorney at law and as a politician brings him in contact with people from all over Guyana, Essequibo, Demerara, and Berbice. He is married to Sita Ramjetan and is the father of two children. Prakash, or Prak, as he is fondly known, was born into and grew up in a grassroots, humble political family on the quarantine. He served as the former chairman of the Progressive Youth Organization between 1988 to 1995, and as a member of the Central Committee 1997 to 2004 of the People's Progressive Party. This former state council in the chambers of the Director of Public Prosecution, a former president of the Ghana Bar Association, has been a member of Parliament since October 1992 and was a member of Public Accounts Committee of National Assembly. He has fearlessly and objectively represented his views on numerous issues, some highly politically sensitive, all in his quest for a better Guyana. Mr. Ramjetan has participated in many national and international workshops and seminars and contributed to numerous discussions and public debates on issues of maladministration, good governance, on due political interference by the state, on professional and unethical behavior, among other topics. He is the editor of the Guyana Bar Review, an ardent cricketer, but a little too old, he says, for the national team. So he is satisfied being president of the Gandhi Youth Cricket Club. I now call on Mr. Ramjetan.
Thank you very much, Paulette. I wish to thank the coordinators of this program and presidential debate, town hall style, because I feel that there is need for scrutiny of our presidential candidates during a campaign period. And I think it is mandatory that anyone seeking public office to ensure that he suffers that scrutiny and examination. I am pleased also that the venue this evening is at the University of Guyana. And there is a special significance that brings me to that conclusion. My father graduated here in 1969. I commenced legal studies here in 1979. And I have two sons, Hemendra and Divish, who are undergraduates here presently. Let me say, at this initial stage, students all, that we are only going to know how to remedy the situation in Guyana unless we know what the situation is. The AFC sees sense of describing our democracy as a fragile one. Some call it an elected dictatorship. I regard, however, a description that I read in a foreign affairs magazine by Professor Goldstone that aptly describes it, and that is, it's sultanistic. I want you to, just for me to go through the attributes of what he was speaking when he did that brilliant analysis in that journal. This is what he said. It is a regime with a national leader who expands his personal power at the expense of formal institutions. One. Two. A political cabal around such a sultan which appeals to no ideology and have no purpose other than maintaining their personal authority. Three. The preservation of some forms and formal aspects of democracy. You can have elections, you can have a national assembly and so on, but it rules above them by installing compliant supporters in key positions. Four, an accumulation and amassing of great wealth, which it uses to buy the loyalty of supporters and to punish opponents. This it manages to do by procuring aid and investment monies, a large proportion of which is then funneled to the Sultan and his cronies. Five, it keeps the masses depoliticized, disorganized, and divided by paying the population off with subsidies, and we're unable to do so by surveillance, media control, and intimidation of the citizens. It is marked by high levels of corruption and unemployment. Those are the six attributes. Students here and members present, does that characterization ring a bell? I see those attributes here in Guyana, where we have a champion of a sultan. Professor Goldstone's analysis posits that sultanistic regimes in this highly digitized world would unravel with astonishing rapidity, leaving even the sultan befuddled. I see our sultan befuddled in Guyana. Apart from such a degenerate political state of affairs, the hard, cold facts as to the state of our economy must also be told. And I want to reveal to you what the World Bank, after it did a major survey in Guyana that included 164 businessmen and 32 hotel owners and tourist establishments. This is what businessmen told the World Bank, and this is not a perception index. This is hard evidence accumulated from the businessmen. Bribes on government contracts, total value of the contracts, 15.3%. Payments to get things done as a percentage of annual sales, 3.5%. So if any businessman in Guyana were to make gross sales of $100 million, 3.5 goes to paying somebody something to do business in Guyana. Another very important set of statistics so that I can give you the true picture, because others will come and say that that's not the picture, has to do with what they found in relation to a number of indices. Pervasiveness of money laundering through our banks. They did the survey with 117 countries. Guyana, 117 out of 117 countries. Brain drain, where 87% of our people leave this country who graduate from this university. 117 out of 117 countries. Reliability of police services, Guyana's ranking, 116 out of 117 countries. Irregular payments and public contracts, 114 out of 117. So if it is not last place we bring in, it's second to last and fourth to last. I want to also indicate to you, students here, that our corruption perception index was 122 out of 160 countries. That source is Transparency International. Let me make it quite clear. These statistics are not a consequence of our people being
innately without capacity. It is very well known that when our Guyanese go overseas, they do well. They procure great wealth and status in those countries. Rather, I would say that these statistics are a result of the sultanistic rule that we have had for the majority of the 45 years since independence. We also have in this country an absolute inequality. The rich are getting richer and the poor poorer. This inequality, I must tell you, creates distrust, creates mistrust. It creates a general disequilibrium. Neighbors cease to look after and check on their neighbors. There is no cooperative spirit. And the result of the madness we see all around us, crime, corruption, violence, especially domestic violence, drunkenness and vulgarity, even on the platforms of presidential candidates. What is also very significant is an impoverishment that traverses the ethnic divide. Every ethnic community in Guyana has felt the impact of this inequality. That is our state of affairs, and what then should we do about it? The Alliance for Change, yes, change it. The AFC has a better vision for a better tomorrow. Underpinning that vision are 12 interconnected approaches that must be followed simultaneously. These approaches involve civil service reforms, educational reform, private sector-driven economy, and hinterland development, amongst so many other reforms. Time will obviously not permit me to make mention of these, but I want to tell you that we must start thinking about entering an industrial era for Guyana. We have to also deal with an education reform that is going to see students like yourselves deal with more the curricula that has technology, science, maths, and engineering. I noticed Mr. Granger mentioned it, the STEM subjects. We also want you to understand that we must have a state development bank and also increase tech-voc education in the regions. This state development bank is something that will cause a capitalization of our struggling entrepreneurs. And also we intend to mobilize not only the Guyanese here, but Guyanese in the diaspora, because indeed, that's what we have to do. Students, I want you to understand that it is not going to be an easy task. The morass that we are in will take very challenging efforts. Very, very difficult times are ahead, but it can be done. We want to state that we, of course, as part and parcel of getting it done, requires constitutional reform. We have to make that president that has emperor's power, which was given by the PNC in 1980, changed. We have to also reduce the taxation levels. We also have to ensure that our security sector is reformed. We are going to bring in the British and the Americans to assist us and implement the Ian Chang's report. But before my time comes to an end, I want to make to you, brothers and sisters here, students all, there is a challenge the AFC will have to address formally, which matters fundamentally to our ethnic circumstance. It is a challenge which our various communities, be they labor, business, students, lecturers, Christians or Hindus, must help solve. And it is this: delivering a Guyanese peace and happiness across the ethnic divide. We have to get to the point of reconciliation and harmony and unity, to the point of transcending ethnic gravitations. A Guyanese peace, lest we forget, will not be built upon empty and half-empty stomachs or human misery or marginalization of any section of our population. We have seen proof of such marginalization from Dr. Lunson's testimony recently in court. And it is repugnant as it is revolting. Our people and our politicians must do everything in our power to create a more enduring trust between all our ethnicities, and for the provisioning of opportunities for all to earn decent incomes, and the education and training that lead to such jobs, and a combined commercial and political will to enforce our labor laws and tax laws that will restore a balance of the distribution of the nation's wealth after a successful generation thereof. This is the alternative the AFC presents, an alternative which sees its young population blurring all boundaries of race and ethnicity as we know them today, and this still young nation being comfortable in its diversity and even stronger for it. And we all, young people, must never suffer like our own UG student, Johansson, who was slaughtered thoughtlessly on a popular city street. Now, like a Tyon Thomas being tortured in a police station. Now, like a valedictorian of this university who can't find a job. These things pain me. They really do hurt. Students all, our tomorrow depends on what choices we make today. 2012 will depend on what we do in 2011. We cannot do the same thing and expect change. It is that simple. We must change to move forward. I plead that you make the right turn and get on board the Alliance for Change to take you there. Thank you very much.
This is Max Rameau with Take Back the Land and the Omojo Village. You are listening to UhuruRadio.com, the online voice of the International African Revolution.
Thank you. Okay, and now for our fourth and final speaker, Mr. Donald Ramatar. May I remind you of the respect you need to show not only for yourself, but also to our presidential candidate. You allowed your presidential candidate to speak, so you need to listen to our next presidential candidate. I now share with you some information about our next speaker. Mr. Donald Rabindranath Ramatar was born on the 22nd of October, 1960, in the village of Karyakarya on the Essequibo River, to Mr. Sam Ramatar and Miss Olive Constantine. His father was a timber grant operator and his mother a housewife. He has 8 siblings. Mr. Ramatar, an economist by training, received his primary education at the Congregational School and the St. Andrew's Primary School. He later pursued studies at a government technical institute and went on to become a graduate of the Department of Economics, Faculty of Social Sciences of the University of Washington. He also pursued studies in what was then the Soviet Union. He began his working career in his father's timber grant between 1966 and 1975. He worked at Gimpex, the commercial arm of the PPP. In 1975, he was appointed manager of Freedom House, a position that he held for 8 years. From 1983 to 1988, he served as a member of the editorial council of the magazine Problems of Peace and Socialism, and as the international secretary of the Ghana Agricultural Workers Union, GAWU, between 1988 to 1993. Having joined the PPP in 1967, he has been in the leadership of the party since 1979, when he was elected to the Central Committee. He became a member of the Executive Committee of the PPP in 1983 and assumed the position of Executive Secretary of the party 1 year after the PPP was restored to office in 1992. He became the General Secretary in March 1997, when Dr. Chedi Jagan passed away, a position he holds today. Mr. Ramachar has had extensive experience within the party and has represented the party on numerous occasions overseas. He has published a number of articles and is a regular columnist for the Mirror newspaper. He was also a member of the ACP EU Joint Parliamentary Assembly and a bureau member of that organization, and a serving member of the Ghana National Assembly since 1992. Mr. Ramachar also served on several corporate boards. Mr. Ramachar is the husband of Biolakshmi Ramachar and the father of three children. Mr. Ramachar.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chairperson. My fellow contestants, members of the diplomatic corps, students, ladies and gentlemen all, it is to me a great pleasure to be talking to students at the University of Guyana, an institution that has a great history. It began its work in 1963. At a very difficult time in our country's history. Since then, the UG has graduated generations of top-class specialists for Guyana and the world. Over the period of time that the PPP civil government has been in office, we had to confront many, many difficulties in our country, in order to try to bring us to the stage where we are today. I want to remind you that when we took office, we had an economy of $274 million. Today that economy has grown to $2.3 billion. We have a debt, a foreign debt, that is 7.5 times the size of our economy in 1992. Today it is less than 50%. Less than 50% of the economy. In our world today, we find that the main trading partners of Guyana, the United States, Europe, are all in serious financial and economic problems. So much so that Greece is bankrupt. Italy is almost bankrupt. Not only are they bankrupt, but their conditions have spread to the rest of the Caribbean. And the Caribbean economies are in serious trouble. However, at the last heads of government meeting of CARICOM, the St. Vincent Prime Minister, Ralph Bunshaw, said that Guyana was the only shining light in the economy of CARICOM. And my friends, that is because at the same time, coinciding with a crisis in the world economy, Guyana's economy has grown every year by an average of 5%. That is, every year, it shows, therefore, in an unfavorable international economic climate, Guyana has rose to the challenge and has outstripped the rest of the region. If that is not progress, my friends, you tell me what is. I'll give you one other figure for the University of Guyana. In 1992, a lecturer one was getting $18,000 a month. Today, he gets $165,000 a month. You are taking us to my kind. You are taking us to my kind. Let me talk a little bit about the future. For you, let us not dwell on the past. Let's talk about the future. Let me say that one of the reasons that our country has not grown faster than it has so far is because we lack cheap energy. Therefore, in the next PPP term of government, energy. In the next PPP term of government, energy is going to be an important factor. That is why we have already started the work to build a new hydroelectric power plant that will give us the infrastructure, the energy that we need to take our country to a higher level. That is what is going to keep our university students at home. And that is what is going to give us the jobs that we require. And we are not also going to confine ourselves only to one area. Already at Scanlon, we have cogeneration, and we are investigating solar power and wind power in our country. To give us what we need in order to develop. That also will give us a possibility to having a larger manufacturing sector and processing for our country. Another area that we see as vital for our development is agriculture. Already 1 week ago, we heard that we are now 7 billion people on this planet. It means that the world will have to feed 7 billion mouths under a time when we have prices of fuel going up. Many countries are using their land to produce biofuel. This could be an opportunity for us because we have land, we have fresh water, we have good farmers, and we will be able not only to secure our own food supply, but we will be able to take advantage of the high prices of food now going internationally. We have a record that we can stand on. And we have plans. We have plans, a record, and we have the people and the political will to do these things. Thank you for your attention.
You're listening to WhoRadio.com, voice of the International African Revolution.
You've been listening to the 2011 general election presidential candidate, the forum which was held on November 10th at the University of Guyana Turkine campus. I'm Ron Bob Semple, and this is Caribbean Forum. We're here until 11 a.m. Here is the news from the Caribbean.
Is your Caribbean news in brief? Compliments of NewsAmericasNow.com. I'm Ken Webb. Haiti is looking for compensation from the UN. St. Lucians and Guyanese both to the polls. Dr. Conrad Murray, now in jail, awaits his sentence. I'll be back after this. Take your message to the world with Carib PR Wire and PR Newswire. Reach the media in the Caribbean and the world with your multimedia PR message. Contact us today. Log on to CaribPR.com. Carib World News and News Americas Now recognizes WCGS in Newark, New Jersey. Thank you for being part of our weekly family of stations. The United Nations is being asked to pay hundreds of millions of dollars in compensation to Haitian cholera victims and their families. The more than 5,000 victims are also demanding a public apology and an adequate nationwide response by the UN, a claim filed last week said. U.S.-based human rights group, the Institute for Justice and Democracy in Haiti, which brought the action, is demanding $50,000 in compensation for each sick person and $100,000 for each death. More than 6,600 Haitians have been killed, and an excess of 475,000 have been sickened by the waterborne disease. St. Lucians are set to go to the polls to elect a new government on the same day as Guyanese. St. Lucia's Prime Minister, Stevenson King, this week said general elections in that country will be held on November 28th. This surprise date means that for the first time in the history of CARICOM, two of its 15 member states will be voting for new governments on the same day. Guyanese will also vote for a new government on November 28th. This is Carib World News in Brief, compliments of News Americas Now. Take your message to the world with Carib PR Wire and PR Newswire. Reach the media in the Caribbean and the world with your multimedia PR message. Contact us today. Log on to CaribPR.com. Carib World News and News Americas Now recognizes WWRL, 1600 AM, New York City, New York. Thank you for being part of our weekly family of stations. On the ET scene, Michael Jackson's Caribbean-born attorney faces sentencing on November 29th, even as his lawyers vow to appeal his guilty conviction. Grenada-born Dr. Conrad Murray is now an inmate in a section of the Los Angeles County Jail where high-profile prisoners are kept after being found guilty of involuntary manslaughter in the death of the King of Pop on November 7th. A 12-member jury returned the decision after less than 9 hours of deliberation. His attorney said, Murray is devastated by the guilty verdict, but is confident he will win an appeal. The 58-year-old doctor is facing up to 4 years in prison. He could also lose his medical license. And in sports, the West Indies were forced to deal with a 5-wicket loss to India this week. India's master blaster, Sachin Tendulkar, top scored with 76 runs to help his side reach the needed 276 runs with 5 wickets intact. The West Indies, which had won a previous 2-test series in Bangladesh by a 2-0 margin, had a comfortable 95-run first inning lead, but they failed to drive home the advantage when India bowled the visitors out for only 180 in the second innings. The next test will be held at Eden Gardens in Kolkata from November 14th to the 18th. The test series will be followed by 5 one-day internationals. That's this week's Caribbean News and Brief, compliments of NewsAmericasNow.com. And until next week, I'm Ken Webb.
Oh, well, thank you very much, Ken Spiderweb. Well, it's not too late to sign up for the second annual Marcus Garvey Legacy Cruise. This year, we will be visiting Labadee, Haiti, and Falmouth, Jamaica, leaving Fort Lauderdale on December 5th and returning on December 10th on board the Royal Caribbean International Liberty of the Seas. Special cruise guests will be Omalia Shatella, chairman of the African Socialist International and leader of the Uhuru Movement, a musician Princess Bella, and yours truly, with my cultural and educational presentation, The Spirit of Marcus Garvey. Prices increase as the ship fills up, so book now. You can call Tanya's Travel at 352-693-3034. That's 352-693-3034. We're looking forward to you joining us as I'll be celebrating a special Earth Day while on board.
You look good out there, baby. In a little tent, oh, just like the river I've been running ever since. It's been a long, long time coming, but I know a change gonna come. I don't know what's up there beyond the sky. It's been a long, I wish I could come out there where you are, baby. A long time coming, but I know, look at here, a change gonna come. Oh, yes it will. Let me say one more thing. Somebody keep telling me, oh boy, don't hang around. It's been a long, a long. If anybody know what I'm talking about, let me see you wave your hand. I know a change gonna come. Oh, yes it will.
Yes, a change's gonna come. The voice of Mr. Al Green. Those of you who've been listening to us when we started the broadcast at 9 o'clock, we had been focusing on the upcoming elections in Guyana on November 28th, and also there'll be elections in St. Lucia on the same day, the first time in history of CARICOM that two Caribbean nations will be holding elections on the same day. Pretty interesting. And yes, they're needs to be changed, not only in Guyana and in the Caribbean, but throughout the world. With all the negativity that we've been hearing, because the only constant in life is change. And we certainly hope that things can change for the better in the Caribbean and throughout the world. Well, overseas Guyanese national Wayne Ford has been advocating change in his native land for quite some time. And we're going to bring you his perspectives that he had aired about a year ago, looking forward to this upcoming elections in Guyana. So let's just get a little taste more. Oh boy, if my mother could only hear me using that kind of English. Oh, let's just listen to Mr. Al Green a little more, and then we'll hear from Mr. Wayne Ford. Enjoy.
As I mark another milestone today and share these special moments with you in cyberspace, I marvel at how our world has changed. I'd like to thank all of you for your many thoughts, birthday wishes, emails, and the wide selection of beautiful songs which you've shared with me. We'll have to drink to that, but before we do, I'd like to share my birthday wish with you. I wish you were here to celebrate with me. But like many of you, if I could make a wish today and a dream for tomorrow, I'd like to see the rebirth and renewal of our beloved nation, Guyana. I'd like to see our country move in a positive direction, free of rampant crime and widespread corruption, becoming a prosperous and progressive nation, healing the wounds of the past. Over the past several years, many Guyanese have left Guyana because of despair under the PNC regime, and they are still leaving today. Today, thousands of Guyanese would like to return home to contribute and live, but cannot do so because of fear. Fear of the existing regime and the sordid state of affairs which have led our nation to unfortunate stagnation. We're all saddened to know that Guyana retains the unenviable position of being the poorest country in South America and the third poorest in the Western Hemisphere. The gross domestic product of our nation is half that of Barbados, one-tenth that of Jamaica, and a fraction of Trinidad's. Why? We also hold the undesirable status of having the highest suicide rate on the continent of South America, with domestic violence and the murder of women and the children being at an all-time high. I believe that it is the fundamental right of all women to live free and productive lives in the pursuit of their own happiness and individual dreams, without the fear of abuse by men seeking male dominance and control. Help and Shelter, which is an NGO in Georgetown, estimates that 1 to 2 out of 3 women in Guyana are victims of some form of abuse. I wish for change. Help and Shelter data 2008 shows that there were 1,000 clients and victims of abuse who were under the age of 18, and that there were 350 reported cases of child rape. It showed that 8 to 10% of boys and 25% of girls have been sexually abused in Guyana. And according to reports from the Guyana Police Force 2009, there were 2,811 cases reported with only 579 charges. Yet many of these atrocities are never reported. I ask you to support Help and Shelter in Georgetown. This assistance center helps abused and trafficked women and children in Guyana and handles about 35 hotline calls per month. As you know, Guyana sits on the U.S. Department, State Department Tier 2 watch list for trafficking in persons and child labor. This must change. I wish for change in our economic freedom policy, where Guyana is ranked 27th out of 29 countries in the Caribbean, South and Central America, even lower than Haiti. Investment in Guyana is hindered by crime, corruption, inefficient and burdensome government bureaucracy, non-transparent regulations, a weak and cumbersome judiciary, and even an inadequately educated force. We lack the human capital to move our country forward, and I wish for change in the freedom from corruption, where the index ranks Guyana 126th out of 179 countries, and where the human poverty index ranks us 48 out of 135 countries. I wish for change. I wish that one day all people of Guyana and those living in self-imposed exile in North America, Africa, Europe, and the Caribbean will come together as one to rebuild our stagnant nation, a nation on the verge of chaos and on the precipice of collapse. A new manifesto must unfold, and an inspiring vision must be articulated where all Guyanese are empowered to pursue their dreams with dignity, respect, and equal opportunity for all. One in which our nation is emboldened with a clear spirit of partnership between Afro-Guyanese and Indo-Guyanese. One in which conditions are created through education and a national unity strategy to ease historic hostility, racial discrimination, and ethnic dissensions which have plagued our nation during the colonial era and even through the post-independence period. These things I wish for. We must shape a new destiny, chart a new course, and bridge the racial divide which has shackled us for decades. And even more so, we must move away from the failed policies, failed strategies of today, and embark on a creative, innovative agenda that fosters hope and opportunity for all people of Guyana. One that catalyzes change through innovation, inclusion, and inclusion of members of the diaspora and all Guyanese. Guyana needs a champion for the people, and not a champion of the earth. I wish for the day when all Guyanese will participate in our own healing, to overcome our history as a broken, divided nation, that when we break the shackles of the past, we can forge a new beginning. These things I wish for. Change from Mabaruma to Anna Regina, Orinduque to Mount Roraima, Lethem to the Quarantine, across mountains, rivers, and streams, from the white sands to the alluvial mudflats, from lush forests to the savannas, Georgetown to Caribbean, change must come. Change we need from the classroom to the boardroom, from Stabroek Market to the halls of Parliament. Change we can embrace. But we all have a role to play. And in the words of Martin Carter, all are involved, all are consumed. And Mahatma Gandhi said it best, we must be the change we want. We must dare to hope, dare to dream, to vanquish the chains of fatigue and despair, seeking new innovation and inspiring leadership with bold new ideas and a clear vision of optimism and opportunity for the next generation. And so, my friends, let us unite with renewed vigor Let us reignite the passion for change and enlightened hope for change we can embrace. One hope, one dream, together one. On November 18, 1978, our nation experienced instant world infamy on a day that will go down as one of the darkest days in our recent history. The murder-suicide of the People's Temple Agricultural Project in Jonestown shattered the national image of Guyana, and as Bob Marley would say, utterly destroyed. Guyana then became synonymous with Jim Jones. And over the years, our national image has been eroded even further and destroyed in many other ways. As the poorest nation in South America, it is estimated that 34% of the population of Guyana live below the poverty line, and 19% live in abject poverty. The nation of Guyana needs a new, effective poverty reduction strategy, one that works and is implementable, one that is measurable in its effectiveness. The existing strategies have failed the Guyanese people. And here are some sad examples of failed policies and strategies. In Region 1, the location of the mortuary at Port Kaituma is inappropriate since runoff waste can get into drinking water. There's a lack of proper facility to preserve the dead. There's a lack of a library for students. Teacher absenteeism and reporting to work under the influence. The lack of potable water. The lack of telephone communication sets at police outposts. The lack of solid waste disposal facility in Region 3. High cost of electricity. Poor quality of drugs. Discrimination in health services provisions. Malnourished children with medical needs. And a list of deficiencies and inadequacies goes on for pages and pages. Distressing and sad. But poverty leads to crime. Other activities, including school dropouts and social ills like domestic violence and murders. The lack of opportunity, poverty, unemployment, human rights violations, and racial discrimination have led to the continued exodus of Guyanese to foreign soil. And Guyana has the highest rate of skilled immigration in the region. It is estimated that over 9,000 Guyanese leave Guyana annually, and we lack, therefore, the human capital necessary for rebuilding our nation. On June 1st, 2009, Barbados enacted an amnesty provision targeting Guyanese who are seeking employment and residency in Barbados. A report from the Council of Hemispheric Affairs, Washington, D.C. states, and I quote, "For a number of years, a struggling economy and persisting racial tensions in Guyana has led to existing job loss, decreased standard of living, and continuous uncertainty in the minds of the Guyanese population." It goes on to say that thousands of restless and desperate Guyanese have made their way to Barbados. Many Guyanese are either deported or are facing deportation from Barbados. This is also true in other parts of the Caribbean and the world. It is said that Barbados officials were charged with designating specific benches at the airport for Guyanese in order to single out illegal Guyanese refugees. This is shameful. And as you're aware, Guyana was once considered the breadbasket of the Caribbean, to which Barbadians, Jamaicans, and others in the region flocked, seeking employment and a better way of life. The role has now been reversed after 44 years of independence and two dominant political parties. There has to be restoration of our national image through a workable poverty reduction strategy and a new effective economic development strategy, along with a revised executable national development strategy. We must create diversification of the economy through manufacturing and other means. We must export more than we import. And there must be more private sector and public sector involvement in the restoration of our nation. We must decrease our dependency on just 13 commodity products and 15 non-traditional agricultural products and create new industries. But we must go even further to restore our image in the international arena. Our educational system, which was greatly admired during the 60s and 70s, is in need of vital reform and funding. Today, our quality of education is poor and substandard. And the United Nations reports indicate that 1/3 of children who complete sixth grade lack basic literary skills. Secondary school attendance stands at only 69%. We need comprehensive education reform. No nation can progress when its youth lack proper education. Our nation cannot progress and prosper when 87% of the University of Guyana graduates leave the country or can't find work. Guyana has one of the highest rates of skill immigration in the world. We're also one of the greatest recipients of remittances relative to GDP in the region. Remittances that account for close to 23% of our gross domestic product. The future of our nation rests squarely on the strength and education of our youth. And as Whitney Houston said, I believe the children are the future. Teach them well and let them lead the way. Show them all the beauty they possess inside and give them a sense of pride to make it easier. Yet, 1/3 of our children under the age of 5 are seriously malnourished, according to UNICEF reports. And HIV/AIDS has left over 7,000 children orphaned in Guyana. How many orphanages currently exist? Once again, the nation tops the list when it comes to child labor. Child labor in Guyana sits at 16%, and that is the highest in the Caribbean. What will our future be? My friends and concerned Guyanese, in Guyana, the rates of infant and child mortality are more than double the average of Latin America and the Caribbean. And according to the World Health Organization reports, we must change direction when it comes to that area. And we must chart a new course and move in a different direction with reforms of our healthcare system. Our nation is endowed with many natural resources: bauxite, gold, diamonds, fertile lands, large tropical forests, bountiful rivers and streams. Yet our beloved nation remains a highly impoverished country where helpless and innocent children are homeless, starving, and dying. Why? Guyana is the third poorest country in the Western Hemisphere. Why? We lack effective leadership. We need visionary leadership and new governance. Fresh faces, new names with bold, innovative thinkers and new blood in leadership capacities. We need change we can embrace. And as we search for new visionary leadership with innovative solutions for relief, recovery, and reform for our nation today, it is important to outline the gravity of this crisis in real terms. And I would add, but the solutions are not simple, neither are they one-dimensional. These problems are complex, pervasive, spanning every sector of the economic landscape and every strata of society. But the solutions require the brain thrust, involvement, and inclusion of all Guyanese, those in Guyana and those living abroad, if we are to move our nation forward in a positive, progressive direction for change we can embrace. And as we brace for elections in 2011, the majority of Guyanese are seeking innovative solutions for relief, recovery, and reform. It's important for Guyanese in Guyana and around the world to raise their consciousness and their awareness of the state of affairs of our nation today. We must reverse the historic levels of inequality, recurrent economic crisis, arrogant power, and resistance by the existing regime. We know we need change and enlightened hope for change we can embrace.
Thank you very much, Mr. Wayne Ford.
Sundays from 7 to 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, we'll bring you Golden Sunday Sounds with me, Ron Bob Semple. A relaxing 3 hours of music from around the world. music is the food of love. So tune in every Sunday evening from 7 to 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time for Golden Sunday Sounds.
Yes, we'll bring you Golden Sunday Sounds tomorrow Sunday from 7 until 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. I'm Ron Bob Semple, and you're listening to Caribbean Forum. Well, on November 5th, 2008, a music icon, Byron Lee, succumbed to cancer. Here's an interview that I did with Mr. Lee just about 5 months before he met his demise. Byron Lee talking about his music and his future.
Music is my passion. It is my life. I've dedicated my life to Caribbean music. And after 53 years, it has paid off, not only financially, but in the discipline and the respect they have now for musicians. Everywhere I go, every single island, they hear about Byron Lee. And when I try to leave by saying to them, same thing, passion for the art, our culture, commitment to that passion, and then the discipline. All three locked together tight.
I'm Ron Bob Semple, and it is indeed a pleasure to have you join me here on Caribbean Perspectives. You just heard the voice of one of the Caribbean's musical icons, Mr. Byron Lee, with whom I had the privilege to sit and chat in Clearwater, Florida. So you can now sit back and relax as we beam and stream here on Caribbean Perspectives.
Mr. Lee, welcome to Caribbean Perspectives. Now, Mr. Lee, you will be 75 years old in a couple of weeks.
73.
How does it feel approaching this milestone?
Well, it's hard for me to say because the music keeps you, it's evergreen for any other profession like sports or anything like that. Age rules you out, right? Not heard of. I'm a football fan. I'm watching the Euro 2008.
The Euro 2008, yes.
And when you hear people say, when them get to 30, on the wrong side of the football,
ready to
you
retire.
Must realize. But I realize this as musicians and artists. And look at Ray Charles, that died the other day, right? People like that. Louis Armstrong, they died when they're old. The profession of music keeps you young. Because I can prove it. Because when I was sick, it was the music that pulled me out. The music, entire entertainment scenario. And the music is like a vitamin. And the doctors said, the doctors up here in Miami who look after me don't understand my reason. And I said, doctor, I must play music. Doctor said, well, take a year from the band. I said, you're telling me, you're burying me now. And it is proven right because when I was in Miami after the surgery, it was hard for me to recuperate a week all the time. He sent me home for 3 weeks. And when I went down there, appetite opened. And everything, I start to put back on the weight. So I'd like just to say that music, after so many years, you'd expect that. I was a bit tired. People says, you're not tired, come off the road. You know, when you're going to retire, those words are not in my vocabulary.
You have played a crucial pioneering role in bringing Jamaican music to the world. Some 52 years after you formed that band, what's the key to your longevity?
Three words, passion, for the art, our culture, commitment to that passion, and discipline. Now, it speaks those three without the other doesn't work. It's like a card game. You have to have a king jack so they get flush. Passion for the commitment. A lot of people have passion. Most of them have passion for the art, but no commitment to that passion. And if they do have those two, then they do have the discipline to dress good on time, rehearsal, the band start on time. So what has saved me over the last half century is the fact that when you go to a Byron Lee party and the promoter says, you're ready to go on? Yes, we go on. right away. So when people come in early, they don't have to sit around for 2.5 to 3 hours before the main act goes on.
From the onset, you determined that your band would be one of the well-dressed, clean professionals. Is this your trademark, and how important is that to you?
When I started music in Jamaica, about 1956, the early 50s, we didn't have a national sound. We didn't have nobody heard of ska, reggae, rocksteady. That is not born yet. So when I got when I used to watch some of the black and white films, I saw how the Elvis Presley, Bill Haley, Benny King, those boys dressed, the Manhattans.
Okay.
So I said, take a page out of the book. And I went out, I think we were the first band to have on a color. We stood the band. All the other bands then in Jamaica used to sit down. They used to play the big band music. Duke Ellington, Glenn Miller. Sheet score, everybody sit down, and the big band. And I came in and I said, I'm going to change things. Jamaica needs a change. And I took to them the stand-up and play band and dance, choreograph. And so the uniform was very important. The equipment, the instruments, to this day we have a policy. If the trumpeter says he blows a wrong note and we leave the instrument, we give it away or sell it the next day and buy a new one. That's what's been my policy, because only then you can get the best, what you call audio-visual. Good sound and good dress. And you carry yourself as well off the bandstand as on the bandstand.
When you attempted that change, was there any resistance from the general panelists?
None at all, because they were watching the same black and white movies as well. We didn't have television in those days.
Right.
We were watching the same Alan Freed, Ed Sullivan.
Okay.
So they were seen, and that was around the time of the Beatles and Rolling Stones.
Who has been with your band the longest?
He's in Jamaica, Carl Brady. He's retired. We retired him. He works in a record company. I own a record company called Dynamic Sounds. And he's there as a manager, one of the managers. But our time frame has been, it's what, 12 of us on the stand now. We have 4 of them who has been in me over 30 years. Another 4 has been with me over 15. And the young boys up there now, and the young girl has just been with me 5 years. So we're looking at 30, 20, and 4 to 5.
Speaking of Carl Brady,
mm-hmm.
yourself, Carl Brady.
Yes.
Ronnie Nasrallah.
Yes.
Altie East.
Mm-hmm.
And Ronald Peralta.
Yes.
You got together with some crude instruments and formed a band. Tell us about that scenario, how that started.
It's what you call, what goes wrong comes wrong. My parents boarded me, so I had to stay there and listen to father or sister. I was a Roman Catholic. And one day, I was giving them trouble. I was a bad boy, you know, that thing like that. So sister said to me, Baron, what is it that you have to do to behave yourself? I said, sister, I want to play music. And I played the piano. And that's how it all started. So when I went to St. George's College, which was the college after I graduated from school, I played football, now soccer. And a lot of people don't know this, that I was one of the schoolboy top scorers in the 1950s at St. George's. I scored 13 goals, 14 for that year. And then when we won those victories in the 55, 56, 57, 3 cups a year we won, I used to celebrate the victories at Emmett Park, and there I met Ronnie Nasrallah, Ryan Peralta, Sester Chu, and Altie East. And we used to rejoice of our victories with music. But the piano upstairs was a big piano. It could not come downstairs.
Yeah.
So I said, I had to play concert. I bought a guitar, you know, I did some lessons. And I went from the piano to the guitar, and then when I said to myself, there's nobody in Jamaica or the Caribbean that plays a bass, it's all standing bass.
Okay.
Then again, I watched the Sullivan Show, I watched the R&B artist, and he's using the electric bass. And I have proven the other day that I was the first person, a musician in the Caribbean, to bring an electric bass into the Caribbean.
Tell me about the door that was used as one of the instruments, the spoon.
Well, yes, the spoon and the door and the biscuit pan and the condensed milk box. You know, it was just a hobby. We played for 3 years without getting a penny. We played from 56 to 59. just for my, we're like a mama and papa band, like the Rolling Stones, like Mick Jagger and the Rolling Stones. Our fans now has grown up with us, and their children and the families of their children come to me to have a complete new generation who said, my mother and father, I was brought up in a house where from morning, noon and night I heard Baroleen music from my parents. Now that I've graduated, I want to go and see what my parents either got married to, engaged to, our birthday party stuff. So we have that following. You know, so the following is still sprinkling. We still have our base foundation, but we have the new people coming in now, the new kids and all like that. Mm. That's where we got to adjust the music to cover. The hardest part of my career has been to cope with the changing times. The repertoire, and if we had stayed in one genre of music, would have been history.
Might not have lasted as long.
History. Because we see what is happening to me now today, that's why I'm fortunate. All the Caribbean promoters realize that I'm one of the very few bands, if not the only one, that when I play the complete repertoire, I get away with it. When I go there last night and play
something else,
dancehall, calypso, Latin.
That's right.
You know, and even the rock and roll.
Sure, and it worked.
Yes.
Are you tough on your musicians?
Yes. And them call my hard taskmaster. You know, because I said to them again another thing that's why I said in the beginning when you asked me what has kept me alive so long. So many things, but I can pinpoint it now. A musician, most of them today, especially on the Caribbean, don't know the difference between music and pleasure, or work and play, because they're very interlocked tight, because they wear this only profession where you play to work.
Yes,
so the musicians go up there and they figure, oh, that's it, the people dancing and drinking and a girlfriend on the bottom of the light, that girl. And that's all the bands that break up, because the musicians, them just feel like they don't come to work, they come to play. Which is that it's a pun on words. So that is why I've to be hard on them.
Last night, you were just on stage for about 15 minutes. However, I observed last night that you are a part of every aspect of that presentation. You are there early, make sure that you're there at the sound check. When I introduced myself to you, you mentioned that there's some stuff that you have to tweak. Is this something that you try to pass on to those younger members of the band, that you have to have this kind of discipline in a leadership role?
The phrase that I have used, which works, it's very simple to understand, and I've drilled it into everybody in the organization, either management, my support staff, the musicians, the technicians. If you fail to prepare, be prepared to fail. Whenever anything happens at all, I use those for that phrase. If you fail to prepare, be prepared to fail. Now look at last night. We came in late, a little late, from Miami. We flew in from Jamaica. We still had to go down there on sound check to make sure that the system is set up. Because the last thing in the world I want to do, and this is where if I write my book, I'm going to say this is criticism of all Caribbean artists, maybe all bad. Why I keep going back to Caribbean is I deal with my music as part of my life. I don't want to compare it to the international world. Caribbean music to me is a passport for all Caribbean people who live in a Caribbean or live abroad. Because when we play abroad in a remote part of the world, we let them be, for that night, a first-class citizen. Except those people, most of them are not first-class citizens, you know that. They're immigrants. So I want them to feel that their music is their pride and joy, and they realize it too. The thing that annoys me, and when I go to somewhere to hear that the band has started before I do, they're good musicians. Why do they have to come so late? And when the people coming in, you hear them checking, testing, one, two, boop, boop. You know what I mean? That's a disgrace to the profession.
Yes, it is.
See, if you come up there and you look, and you're coming in to pay big dollars at the door, and you look and you see the people dressed in T-shirt, sneakers, and they're starting, you said that is taking us back 20 years ago.
Yes, sir.
So I have tried in the 50 years to bring the standard of the music of the Caribbean artists to a level where when you put it up against any foreign act, regardless of how big they are, we can at least hold our own.
On a personal note, sir, your father was of African descent, or as some may say, ascent.
Your mother was Chinese.
No, the other way around.
The other way. I'm sorry.
Your father was Chinese.
Yes,
and my mother
and
was
your
Jewish.
Mother, yes,
African. African descent, yes.
How did their different backgrounds and cultures mold Byron Lee?
Well, then it was what you call, I was heartbroken then, because music, when I started it, was not something you look up to. It was something that was for the poorer people or musicians. They had brought it on themselves. They, first of all, they took the money in front and didn't turn up or came drunk and came the same way, out of uniform and all of that. So when I started, I said, my father called me, says to me, Byron, I spoke broken English, Chinese. He says, I send you to school, you get a good education, right? I want you to be a doctor. I know you go play music. Foolish boy. But my mother always said to me, don't follow him, don't follow your father. And she bought the piano for me, and that's where I started to play. So for me to learn to play, we dedicated from her. When I went to Haunted Court to a cowboy movies the weekend, we lived in the country in Christiana, in Jamaica. I had to play half hour piano for her before she took me to the theater. But my father also gave me acute business sense that the Chinese, you know, are noted for, where money is important, but what comes first is whatever you are doing. Look at the Beijing Olympics now. It's going to be one of the most fantastic things, because the Chinese feel that they're looking down the road. They're not looking for the present and the recover the money right away. They want to make sure, the same with the band, the performance fee, I can play with, but that never compromises sound or the presentation, those two things. Because at this stage, you know, you have to hit promoters somewhere. Western promoters are struggling. So you set yourself, what your gates, what you do, and you make different arrangements.
When not playing music, what does Byron Lee do for relaxation?
Music.
Alan Bomar Jones, and you're listening to Caribbean Forum with Ron Bob Simple.
Have any of your children been a member of this band at any time?
None. The closest I came was my brother. My brother who used to play guitar. Oh, my family. Sorry, my family. My brother, two brothers, are, you heard of Third World?
Yes.
Third World. But my brother, Willie Stewart, was a drummer in the Third World band.
Okay.
He started with me first.
Okay.
I trained him, and then he moved on to a band called Third World.
Ebo
and Willie Stewart. Mm-hmm. Willie Stewart, the drummer. The great drummer.
Okay.
My brother. My other brother called Pablo, or Paul, had a band called, what's the name of the band? Oh, no. Tropics. Yes, Tropics. But he died. And so that's the second part. My other cousin, my nephew had a band called Roots. And so the whole family, but my children are not musical, man. My daughter is. One of my daughter played the piano. She's a lawyer. And my other daughter loves the business where she is helping the promotion and the website and everything. But apart from that, there is nobody else. And my two sons run the record company. So I'm very fortunate to have a part of the family that's in the record business, a music business, but not actually musicians who run the record company. And then I have my other daughter who's helping me now with the website and Carnival. And then my other daughter who plays the piano, just professional, not professionally, just amateurly.
Speaking of Carnival, let's go back to 1990, when you launched the Jamaica Carnival. Was that a risky venture?
It was a risk then, and it is still a risk. Because, unfortunately, Jamaica really hasn't proceeded where I thought it would be. Jamaica is the last of the 26 islands in the Caribbean now they're the younger baby in the block. Before that, we went to Trinidad every year for 37 years. I was on the road for 20 in Trinidad, Barbados, St. Lucia, Grenada, Antigua. All those people have carnival. We're called Eastern Caribbean. Jamaica was considered not a part of the Caribbean. We had reggae music. We had a different time. We were always behind, one hour behind. And so therefore they considered us a Northern Caribbean, which meant that with us, Bahamas and Cayman didn't know about Calypso at all. They knew about reggae, rocksteady, ska. So when I went to Trinidad every year and I saw the amount of fun and excitement and euphoria that the people on the road got on Carnival Day, where on that day, everybody was one for Carnival Day. You didn't have up, down, mid, down.
Okay.
You had one person, people of all walks of life. I said, I had to take them back to Jamaica. But I had difficulty in the beginning. One, the reggae fraternity. They know that whenever I do anything, I do it very well. They feared that I'd take soca music or calypso and hurt the reggae or dancehall. And I went to go on the radio a couple of times on TV and says, gentlemen, I'm a musician from long time. I helped start the music here. If you think that 3 months or 3 weeks of soca music can damage reggae, then take another look at the reggae. It meant it was never ever that strong. And from those words, they accepted it. So now what is magnificent about it is Carnival just finished. We're on the road again. 120,000 people, most of them dance or reggae, roots man, was on the road jumping up the calypso. The Rasta guys, them locks flying, jumping up and dancing and singing.
So initially, because of your popularity, did the natives feel that you might have been competing against the Trinidadian carnival?
Sorry, start again. I mean, the Trinidad. Yeah.
When you formed the Jamaica carnival,
yes.
Was there the sense that Byron Lee is popular and now he's crossing over into our side of the fence?
Oh, you mean from the southeast and the Caribbean? Yes, that is correct. Because in fact, I tell you this: when I started it, their BWI was running. They support their carnival everywhere because their product is their trademark. They flew their bands all over the world. When I started in Jamaica, they wouldn't give me a ticket at all. And one of the remarks that the BWI chairman said to me, I knew him well, Mr. Lee, how can you expect us to support Jamaica because you're going to take away our music? And I told him the same thing. I said, if we as a reggae country, using carnival now after your trend, then it was 110 years. Or 108, Jamaica Carnival is now 20 next year, 20 years. Then I say, your carnival of how your procedure of your event is not what it's supposed to be. Because we are, Jamaica Carnival is only an implant of the Trinidad Carnival, as I know it, done in Jamaica.
And in certain instances, an extension.
Extension. It's like a transfusion, mm-hmm. a transfusion of culture and music. And the thing about it is this, that our music in Jamaica, dancehall, when it goes into the Caribbean now, they're pulling a bigger crowds than your local things. We could train that 45,000 people down there when Sean Paul the other day down there went, and Shaggy, and Beanie Man. 40,000 people. No calypso act or soca act can pull that amount of people, and they know it.
Why do you think this reggae beat has lasted so long?
Again, couple things. It came at the right time. You know the phrase that there is nothing before its time is correct. And how I had a part in that again is my studio was one of the most developed, sophisticated studios in the 70s. And all of the British acts came to Jamaica to record, right? One, because the grass was greener, right? Mm-hmm. And they're influenced by Jamaican music, because Jimmy Cliff, Peter Tosh, and Bob Marley. And Eric Clapton called me and said to me, I want to record in the studio, and I want you to do advised me what tune must do for Bob Marley, from Bob Marley. So I looked at it and said, you have a choice. You can either do I Shot the Sheriff, and I played them for him, and he picked I Shot the Sheriff. And that's how it was projected into the world. That is why it's reggae, the music of Jamaica, maybe with us come now, take a long time. But then in the 1972 period, when Jamaica, the world was looking for something new, along came Clapton, top artist, who recorded I Shot the Sheriff. In 1 week, it went to the Billboard charts. 6 million. 6 million copies. They just sell singles then, no CDs. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. 6 million copies. And that projected the music of reggae into the international world And then it set up Bob Marley was ready, and he came, you know, as a forerunner. And he was really the man who made Jamaica known and the music of reggae known. So that is why, now to talk about the musical end, why reggae is hard to break. Soca is hard to break alongside reggae. The musical, the Caribbean people are lazy people. They're laid back. And you notice you're laying back to 106 beats a minute or 100 beats. Soca music today in the road is 160 beats in them. So how many, when it with Jamaica, you can't last long when it do that. So what I think is hurting soca music is that the producers in Trinidad think of one thing only, the road march. Mm-hmm. And they beam everything to the road march. You don't realize that when Carnival is finished, you have 9 months of the year that people have to do, listen to easy music. Mm-hmm. Like, and I remember once I spoke to a lady, she's an American, Afro-American, she's a nurse in New Jersey. She said, Mr. Lee, you know, I buy all your records, because it has a groove about it, soca. Even though when you buy the other people's records, and I'm coming home from work and I'm in traffic, you're jumping away, boop, 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 jump. Mm-hmm. It throws off the mind. Music mm-hmm. is a powerful medium.
Yes,
know?
It is.
So when you lay it back, boom, back, boom, back, it gives you the space to breathe, because the space is also an instrument. The space, and is what I criticize all the time, soca music for. You're trying to capture the live music on the road to put on disc, which can't work. It has to be an event. There's no other music like soca or calypso for the road marches, or the parade. But when it comes to recording, longevity, right, continuity, you have to come pull the beat back, and that's why reggae now is so popular, because it is right close to the rap, because you hear how Sean Paul has cross-fertilized it with the rap and the dancehall.
And it works.
Right, it works. Yeah. Works.
What's ahead for Byron Lee?
Well, I feel that as long as I'm alive, and there's no life without music, as I said to the doctors, Dr. Bashan, he said to me, well, you have to make up your mind, you're going to come off the road, you're going to let somebody else run the band. I said, doctor, can't work. He says, why? I said, because you're sentenced me to death. You're sentencing me to death. My life is around the music. And even if I go on holidays to relax, what relaxes you is what I work for me, music. Mm-hmm. So I'm always committed. And but there is nothing, because look at last night. I enjoyed myself so much last night. It was, as you say, a play to work, but I think more of the playing. As long as the people are happy, as long as when you leave, people come to you and say, great job, I enjoyed myself, I got the money's worth. You see, when we play like the last night, we played for 2 hours and 20 minutes, 2 hours and 15, right through, no breaks, no stop, right. No talking,
that's
nothing.
Right. Right.
Running here, music here, all the genres of music. We played about maybe 9, 10
sure
different
did.
Types of music,
yes.
Back to back. Nobody left the floor.
No, they didn't.
Yes.
Including yours truly.
Yes.
The reason I chuckled before, when you retire, in whose capable hands will the Dragonaires be left?
Well, you have asked a question that I put here, right? I was asked, when are you going to retire? I'll use the same interview that Mike Douglas used when Ray Charles was alive. He says, Ray, who's one of my great, great mentors, because Ray Charles with his big band and everything, he was one of the people that started and influenced Byron Lee. And Mike Douglas said to him, when are you going to retire? And you know, Ray Lee put on his glasses and said, that glasses, like you're looking for something. He said, from what? From what? What are you going to retire from? So you see, because there's no other substitution, that like you said, you're going to sell insurance today and put a car tomorrow. The music and this entire scenario, demographics, is one which no musician can retire from.
And especially, you've been listening to an interview I conducted with Mr. Byron Lee just about 5 months before he met his demise back in 2008. Well, thank you for listening to Caribbean Forum this week with me, Ron Bob Semple. We'll be back tomorrow Sunday. Golden Sunday Sounds from 7 until 10 p.m. Watch your thoughts. They become words. Watch your words. They become actions. Watch your actions. They become habits. Watch your habits. They become character.